Well, Joel 3 talks about the Messianic era. And it says that, and it states in verse 3, "And it shall come to pass afterwards that I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, your old men shall dream dreams, your young men shall see visions, and also upon the servants and upon the handmaids in those days will I pour out my spirit. And I will exhibit wonders in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and the terrible day of the Lord." Okay, so now the, and then it says, "And it shall come to pass that whoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered." And that's the sentence, the verse that David was referring to. That what does this mean, calling on the name of the Lord? Because apparently it's going to be a time where there's going to be a lot of tragedy. Now, when it says the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood, this, of course, Maimonides and other scholars explain clearly, this is not a literal, not to be taken literally, it is a metaphor. Because it means to say, when it says the sun will be, when it says that the sun will turn to darkness, it means to say that the people's emotions are going to be totally, they will be terrified. So it's, and in Isaiah you have many times where it speaks about the heavens. Maimonides makes it quite clear that it's the prophet's metaphor, his way of telling us that it's going to be a terrible tragedy for people and people are going to be really suffering. But it doesn't mean literally that the moon is going to be turned into blood. Now, the question that David asks does say, "Whose heaven the Lord shall," and that's why a lot of people think that saying God's name, the name that that Jehovah refers to, it's okay for me to say J, because there's no, that can't be the name, because there's no J in Hebrew. So that name, they think, will have certain powers because of this verse over here. But that is completely erroneous, and let me explain why. Because, by the way, you know, people who are who have you know, messianic complexes, get into this mystical kind of stuff, like for instance Sabbatai Tzvi, who Dave mentioned to me last week and reminded me that was one of the things he used to do. He used to use the ineffable name because they're attracted to that, as if there's some mystical powers that the name has. And Maimonides speaks about this in the guide. He speaks about the people, the foolish people who thought that the name of God has mystical powers. And then they used to write it down on papers of, you know, use it for all kinds of superstitious means. And it became like holy incantations through which they thought they can divine certain things and assume and you know, assume certain powers. But all this is basically nonsensical. What we have to do is, you see, you have to understand what the Torah is. And that's the whole concept of the oral law. The oral law means that God gave us a way to approach the Torah, an approach. Of course, you could take the Bible and you could approach it any way that you want. But the concept of the oral law is that God could never have given the Bible without an interpretation, because, as you see, you could read the Bible to people, read the Bible and make it mean whatever they want. Paul was able to read the Bible and make it mean that you don't keep the commandments, even though Moses in Deuteronomy says it over and over and over again that all that God wants is that the people of Israel should take commandments. And, you know, you can just talk everything away. You can just say, well, that wasn't important or whatever. But the God would never have allowed us to be to have a book which would be worthless, since anybody can interpret it any way they wish. So the concept of the oral law is that God gave Moses the proper method. He entrusted Moses the proper method of how to interpret and how to understand the Bible. And this went from Moses to Joshua to the elders and straight through Samuel, all through the prophets, and then of course after that there was the scholars, the Sanhedrin, that it went straight through till our day, actually, all the scholars till our day. And God stated in Isaiah that the Torah will never cease from the mouths of the people of Israel. Because if it would cease, then there would be no purpose in giving it. It would just last for a short time. The purpose was that it was supposed to be an everlasting law, an everlasting covenant, and therefore guaranteed us one thing, that this interpretation of the Torah will always survive. Now, it's rather easy today to make a decision as to what the interpretation of the Torah is, because there's only one system that survived, and that's the system, the Talmudic system. There were other systems. There were Sadducean systems, as you know. those all perished. And the Essenic systems, there were many, many people who thought that they could interpret the law, the Torah, the Bible. But the one system that has been in existence from the time of the giving of the Torah till today, and even historians who don't know anything about the history of our tradition agree that the last 2,000 years, at least, have been dominated totally by the Talmudic scholars, and all of Israel has performed and acted and kept the laws and the commandments solely by the Talmudic method. So it's rather simple way to observe it that really has proven the test of time and has followed exactly as the prophet stated God's promise to sustain it, and that is the Talmudic method of analysis of Torah. Now, the Talmudic method of analysis of Torah, as you know, tells us and teaches us that the Torah is essentially a book of knowledge. And it means it's not a mystical book. So you can't come along and just pull out these names and just, you know, look at a verse and check the what the word means here and the word means there, and you're going to say that this is exactly the same thing. That's not true. You have to look at the context. You have to look at the sense of the sentence, and that's the way you interpret it. You don't just there are many words in the Torah. For instance, the word heart. The word heart sometimes means evil inclinations, where it says in the Bible, you shouldn't turn after the after your heart and after your eyes. Over there, it means the lust of the heart, the emotions. Sometimes the heart is a good thing, where it says, where the prophet says, now I'll give you a heart, which means to say that you'll have intelligence, knowledge. So the thing, you can't just take a word and go through a concordancia and just look it up and just say it always means the same thing. That would be, if it were a mystical, if the Bible were a mystical work, you could perhaps do something like that. Mystical writings do work that way. But the Torah is not written that way. The Torah is written in an intelligent way so that man can improve himself by gaining knowledge. So therefore, whenever you see a verse, I'm just giving this as a preface, which I think is quite important. Whenever you see a verse, you always have to look at the context and the framework in order to understand it. Now, the people that think that this verse in Joel means that if you say God's name, you're going to be saved somehow magically, have no concept of how to study or analyze Torah. So what does it mean, those who call out in the name of God? Now, we have to understand what it means. What does a name mean? Now, if we want to know what a name means, look at the beginning of Genesis, called names to all the animals and all the wildlife. Now, what does this mean? This means to say, when he called them names, it means he defined them. So a name is always a definition, a word which gives us a concept of that which we name. This was carried out even in so far as people's names are concerned. Moses, the Talmud tells us, had 10 names. Jethro had 7 names. Why do people have so many names? The answer is because the names have different characteristics of the person. And that's why the name isn't just, even with regard to people, years ago the name had some concept. Like, for instance, when the matriarchs, when they named their child, so they said, like Leah said, I will thank God. So she called his name Judah, of course it comes from the word thanks. So she wanted to eternalize that idea. So names are ideas. There's an idea behind the name. Now the name of God contains, the name that we have got, is a name that contains the highest level of understanding that man can have of God's existence. So it's a reference to the Creator. It's the proper idea concerning the Creator, and it is the most abstract and the most purified concept that man can have of God. That's what that letter, that's what those four letters express in that phrase. Now today we don't know exactly what it is, but we know it has something to do with existence. And many scholars speak about, you know, what the reference is. But basically, it means, in the most basic form, it means it's a reference to God's existence and that his existence is different than everything else in the created world. He is the source of all, etc. In terms of the knowledge of what that name is. Now, what the prophet is saying over here when he says that he who calls in the name of God will be saved means to say that he who prays to the real God will be saved. Of course, to call in the name of God means to pray. If you take a look, you have the exact same expression, as a matter of fact, in Genesis, where it states in the generation of Enosh, which is in Genesis 4:26, and it says, use the exact same name, to call then. Now this word, I want to tell you, this word is translated in two ways. It says, and into Seth also there was a child born, and he called his name Enosh. And then it says, your translation probably reads, then they began to call in the name of God. That's one way to interpret. Rashi says that word in Hebrew does not mean begins, but it means it was at that time. It comes to the word chulin, which means to contaminate, to make it unholy. So according to Rashi, it means then they called in the name of God in an unholy manner, which means idolatrous. Okay. So, but either the interpretation is not important. I just want to show you that either way, it doesn't matter. But the idea of calling in the name of God, whether you say at that time they didn't call in the name of God properly, or whether you say they began to call in the name of God, whatever it is, but the reference is always going to be the same. Calling in the name of God means to pray to the proper idea of God. Okay? If you say that word huchal means, as Rashi says, so it means they failed to do this, to call properly in the name of God. If you say they began to call in the name of God, it also means the same thing, means they began to call properly in the name of God, which is the exact same phrase that you have in Genesis, exact same phrase is found in Joel. So calling in the name of God is not a mystical thing. It doesn't mean in Genesis they started to enunciate this name and somehow gain some magical powers. What it means is to call in the name of God, and it says, stated in Psalms, that God is close to all those who call in his name in truth, which means to say that they have the proper, the true idea of God, and they relate to him properly. It's not an idolatrous idea. So that's exactly what Joel means. What Joel is saying is, the prophet Joel is telling people that there's only one thing that will save them, and that's the true knowledge of God, and the proper way to call upon him, and to relate to him, and to pray to him. So it means that two things are necessary in order for the people to be saved, and that is that they have the proper idea of God, and also that they recognize that God relates to man, and therefore, once you recognize God relates to man, you have to call up, because every human being, no matter what his situation, always must turn to God for whatever it is, whether it's financial needs, psychological needs, physical needs, it always is something that a human being is a creature that is always in a state of need, whether it's knowledge, he may need knowledge. He may need to repent, but a human being is always in a state of need. So once a person recognizes the true idea of God, and then he recognizes that God relates to man, he will call upon God. He has to turn to God. It's the most natural thing for him to do. So that's what the prophet Joel is saying. He's stating that the other people will be lost, but the ones that will not be lost, that will be saved, are the ones that call upon God. It's very interesting. Maimonides mentions this verse too, because Maimonides says, if you take a look at the end of the verse, it says, the remnant, those whom the Lord shall call. So, in my mind, he says, you see that in that time, the amount of people, true idea of God, and extreme minority. And he implies a very small amount that will escape. So, the true idea of God is something which will not be found in the days of the Messianic era. At that time, at that catastrophic moment, there will not be very many people that will have the true idea of God, which shows, the prophet is trying to show, that the true idea of God is not a simple matter, and it's something which is rare, because it requires requires knowledge, and it requires a desire for a person to seek the truth. It's interesting, somebody was just mentioning to me yesterday, happened to be Ben Noach that I was speaking to on the phone, and he was talking to me about faith, and I mentioned to him that Psalms says, where Psalms God looking down upon the children of man, Psalms 14 doesn't say that God looks down upon the children of man to see if there's anyone that has faith. It doesn't say that. It says, God, Psalms 14:2, the Lord looked down from the heavens upon the children of men to to see if there were any of understanding, intelligence, knowledge, that is searching for God. He told me his translation was a little bit different, but this is the translation in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's Hayesh Maskil. God looks down upon people and says, is there an intelligent person, a person of understanding, a person of knowledge that is searching after God? That's what God looks for. See, God is not looking for a man of faith. A person is just committed to this idea, and no matter how, on the contrary, faith usually means irrationality. And no matter how crazy it sounds, we're going to believe in that. That's what the religious world means usually when they say faith. But Psalm says just the opposite, that God doesn't look for anybody like that. That's an idolatrous kind of religion, where God looks for a man of intelligence and knowledge of the truth and in search of God, in search of the true God. And that's exactly what Joel was saying, the same concept. Okay. So I mentioned that because David raised the question about the name. But now let us continue, and we don't really have much more here in the Talmud concerning this law of what is referred to euphemistically as blessing God. The next thing we have is we have a statement of the rabbis. And it says that if you take a look at the verse in Leviticus 24, if you remember, is where that incident was and where this law is mentioned in Torah. So the Talmud says if you take a look. Hello? Okay. If you take a look at that law in Leviticus 24, you will see that when it states the law, it says, and now I don't know how your translation is, but I'll give it to you in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it says, first there was the incident, and then Moses came down and gave the law. And in Leviticus 24:15, it states, "And to the people of Israel you shall say, you shall speak, saying, which means if he curses God." Now it says a man twice. So the Talmud says, why the repetition? Why does it have to say the word a man twice? So we have as follows that the Talmud states that it comes to include the Ben Noach. A man means two different men that keep the Torah system. One is the Ben Israel, and one is the Ben Noach. So, therefore, it's coming to teach you that even the Noahide has to keep this law. Okay, now the Talmud raises a question. The Talmud says, of course, the difference is that the Noahide, the death penalty is always by the sword. It's not by the, as I spoke about last time, it's not the through the more severe death penalties of the Sanhedrin. But now it says like this. Now the Talmud asks a question. Talmud says, how can you tell me that the cursing of God is derived from this verse when in fact we know that Noahide laws are derived from Genesis? So why would you have this? You can't have repetition in the Torah. If we know that the laws are derived from Genesis for the Noahide, why is it that how could I say that this is coming to teach me this one law? There's no reason for that, because we have all the laws of the Noahides already before this. So the Talmud answers as follows. Talmud says like this. The Talmud says that this is going according to Rabbi Meir's opinion. This previous statement is going to the statement of Rabbi Meir's opinion. Okay? Now we have to have a little patience here. Now, what is Rabbi Meir's opinion? Rabbi Meir's opinion was that that when it says when the Bible in that verse where it says a person that curses God will carry his sin, so in the next says he curses the name of God shall be put to death. So he says as follows that the reason why it was necessary to have that verse is because from the verse which states there are two verses. One verse states he who curses the name of God shall be put to death. That's one verse. Let me just get it for you. That verse is verse 16. he who curses the name of God shall put to death. The entire nation shall stone him. And it says the whether he's a proselyte or whether he's a born Jew doesn't make any difference. When he curses the name, he shall be put to death. That's verse 16. Now Rabbi Meir says, but there was no necessary to what was necessary to have verse 15, where it says each man, if he curses God, he shall carry a sin. When it tells you that he's going to be put to death, it's understood because he committed a sin. So why the duplication? So Rabbi Meir says that there's no duplication. But there are two different laws over here. Verse 16 is teaching you, it says, if he curses the name of God, he shall be put to death. All right? Now that implies when he curses, he has to use the name of God, which is the name of four letters. All right. So if I only had verse 16, I would say that if he uses the actual name of God, then he committed the sin of cursing God. But let's say he uses other names of God. There are seven names of God, and he uses another name of God. I don't want to say it because I'm not supposed to say it unless they have reason to. Let's say it's another name, another reference to God. So then I would say he shouldn't be put to death. He's not in violation. That's why it says his God now carries, implying that he doesn't have to use the name. But if he simply curses God in any way, with any kind of reference to God, it doesn't matter what the reference is, whether it's the highest reference, which would be the name of God, or whether it's any reference, even if he used, for instance, the word God, any name which is commonly understood to mean the creator of the universe, would suffice to place him under that violation. So that's why Rabbi Meir says that it's not only, that's why you had to have verse 15, because verse 16 would imply that if he used the name of God, then he should be put to death. Verse 15 tells you even if he uses a reference, it's enough to have him put to death. So, of course, you'll ask me if that's the case. So then why don't you just have verse 15? Why doesn't it just say, in verse 16, it could have just said, he who curses God, why does it have to use the name of God? That's a legitimate question. In other words, Rabbi Meir is explaining if you have verse 16, you still need 15. But you could have one verse by just not using, instead of saying, he who curses the name of God, and using the name over there, shall be put to death. It could have said, he who curses his God, which would mean in any way whatsoever, as long as he's a reference to his God. Okay? That's a legitimate question. In my opinion, the reason is as follows. That there are two, when we say if a person curses God and he doesn't use the name, now this is a subtlety, but I'm going to ask you to just bear with me a little bit. When a person uses, if it would have just said verse 15, for instance, then what I would think is that when a person curses God, it doesn't have to involve the name at all. It means just cursing any person is culpable. But when verse 16 comes along, what it's telling you is as follows, that really the only way that a person could be culpable for cursing God is where he makes a reference, where he uses the name, the actual name. But if you use another name of God, the reason why the person is also culpable, in addition, is because that other name is related to the real name. So the reason why the person is committed under violation is always because he has disgraced the real name of God. But there are two ways to disgrace the real name of God. One way is directly by using the real name. And the other way is by using another name which, by association, brings to mind the real name. Okay? So really, the reason that the person is considered in violation is only because of the real name. That's really what he's degrading. He's degrading the holy name of God. But he can either degrade it directly or by way of innuendo. So the reason why this is considered such a serious violation is because the holy name of God has been disgraced. But you can disgrace that holy name either directly or through innuendo. Now, if the Torah would not have had both verses, you could never know this. Because if it, for instance, had the latter verse, then I would think only if you actually use the name of God. If it would have the prior, the former verse, so then I would say that the reason why the person is in serious violation has nothing to do with disgracing the real God. It's just because any name will do. But that's not correct. And this is where the Talmud is very precision. It sounds like it's, you know, it doesn't make any difference, but actually it's important to understand precisely how the law is formulated. And that is that the essence of the violation is not disgracing God through any name. It's disgracing the holy name of God, that very special name. But that very special name can be disgraced in two manners, either by using it directly or else by another name, and then you're disgracing it via association. But the disgrace is always associated to the holy name of God, the name of God that is the YHVA. Okay? Now, that's why you need both verses. The first verse, you must have both, because the second one tells you what the essence of the violation is, and the first one tells you that even though you don't use that name directly, but you use another name which is associated to that name, that too is enough to make you culpable. Just mere association can make you culpable. What's the method of association? Using another name of God. But the essence of the violation is degrading God's holy name. Okay. Now, it's important for us to know this. You ask me, but why? What difference does it make? Which way it works? The answer to that is that, and here I say that the concept is the reason why you have to have precision in all these formulations is first of all to know exactly how to deal with a person, because you cannot really impose a penalty if the person.